The Trump Effect, today on The World. I'm Marco Werman. President Trump changes his mind, often. It's a fact of life in today's Washington, but that doesn't mean officials in other countries are getting used to the whiplash.
You know, countries that have just about steeled themselves to do painful things to keep on side with America and to deal with this very assertive American president, he then changes his demand, or they can't work out actually what his demand is.
And that may help explain why some Latin American leaders were relieved when Trump announced he was skipping the Summit of the Americas in Lima, Peru this week.
You know, there's a silver lining to not having the kind of unpredictability and impulsiveness of the U.S. president here at the summit.
So much for diplomacy. Those stories, plus a missing princess, today on The World. I'm Marco Werman, and you're with The World on a Friday. Thanks for joining us. President Trump and his administration have issued some pretty contradictory statements over the past few weeks. First, there was, we're pulling out of Syria. Then, we're attacking Syria in the next 24 to 48 hours. And then, well, maybe not so soon. We found out that the U.S. will try to rejoin TPP, the Trans-Pacific Partnership Trade Pact. This after dismissing it for months as terrible for America. Don't even get us started on trade wars, the Iran deal, or James Comey. It is exhausting. So how is this kind of Washington whiplash understood by America's allies, not to mention its enemies? To get some insight, I'm joined by David Rennie, Washington bureau chief for The Economist. David, you're from the UK, so let's get your take first on how this is all seen from there. We hear that Prime Minister Theresa May is considering joining a U.S. strike on Syria, but now Defense Secretary Mattis is gingerly walking back this possibility of action. What are you hearing from London about how the government of one of America's closest allies still views this administration?
Well, remember that Britain was jumpy when President Obama was contemplating strikes against Syria to punish them for chemical weapons strike. And in fact, it was the previous British government that couldn't get a vote through Parliament and actually let Obama down. So Britain has been jumpy for a while. But I think the thing that is particularly different about President Trump is, you know, his basic message to his allies and to his foes is the time for kind of playing games is over. America is going to be extremely assertive. If you don't sit down at the table and start doing deals with me, then you're going to suffer the consequences. So it's taken a while, but America's allies and foes have got their heads around that. And they are, as you'd expect, because America is a very big and powerful country, they are ready to do deals. But here's the problem. Because, as you said in your intro, he keeps jumping backs and forwards. He'll tweet one policy, then discover from his own advisors that it's actually not possible or that it might have risks he hadn't contemplated. You know, countries that had just about steeled themselves to do painful things to keep on side with America and to deal with this very assertive American president, he then changes his demand, or they can't work out actually what his demand is. So he's setting up this world of deal making, and then he doesn't come to the table with a coherent ask.
In this sort of last few days dealing on Syria, is there an upside in the U.S. and the U.K. kind of drawing closer together?
It's a very odd thing. If you watched only the UN Security Council and you watched the way that the U.S. ambassador Nikki Haley works with the British ambassador and the French ambassador, the confrontations that they had only today with the Russian ambassador, it would all look pretty conventional. But the problem is that there's another leg to the American position, which is President Trump, who, having said during the campaign trail, remember that the one thing you shouldn't do is telegraph your military decisions in advance. He used Twitter to telegraph his military plan in advance, while the allies were still waiting for international inspectors to provide them with proof that this was a chemical weapons attack, which is a very important element of pushing back against Syrian and Russian propaganda. So the chaos on the American side and the mixed messages and the kind of drawing of red lines that then are being kind of fuzzed a bit, this is exactly what the world didn't want.
Let's talk the TPP, the flip-flop yesterday on the Trans-Pacific Partnership. What are you hearing from America's partners in East Asia?
They would love America to rejoin the TPP. But what they're really, I think, agonized by is that Trump is picking the right fight with China. There is a lot of impatience and dismay in the whole global trading system with the way that China has behaved for years when it comes to cheating on trade rules. So if Donald Trump patiently assembled a coalition of allies to stand up to China to say this has to change, that has to change, he could be in a very good position right now. Instead of which, by blowing hot and cold on TPP. But I also remember he's currently threatening Japan with tariffs on Japanese steel and aluminium. He has not given Japan an exemption. It's then very hard for those allies to turn around and say, we agree with you on China, let's work together in this very coherent way, because they're seeing Donald Trump picking fights with them in other trade arenas.
Well, as long as we're talking adversaries, Russia said this week it doesn't listen to Trump's tweets. When it comes to security issues, they only listen to Defense Secretary Mattis. I guess that's just being practical. Looking for the upside here, David, because that's what I need to do. Is there any utility in having an incoherent commander-in-chief diplomatically?
Well, I mean, famously, political strategists will talk about the madman theory, where you keep your adversary guessing by, you know, making them think that maybe the ruler is, you know, capable of pushing the nuclear button or picking a fight that you weren't expecting. The thing about that theory is the trick of the madman theory is not to actually literally have a madman. I'm not saying that Donald Trump is mad, but you want to pretend to be chaotic and unpredictable. You don't want to be chaotic and unpredictable. That doesn't bring quite the same rewards.
And finally, since you're in D.C., I'd love to know how the diplomatic corps in Washington is dealing with all this, because they have to relate to the U.S. government, this particular government.
It's a nightmare, and it has to be said that they're not especially happy right now that John Bolton is the national security advisor. They remember John Bolton from when he served in the Bush administration. There's not a lot of trust for him. Remember also that in May, very big decision coming up to do with whether Donald Trump extends the Iran nuclear deal, which is basically an American-European deal with Iran to all intents and purposes. The Europeans are willing to move a lot. They're willing to make some concessions, but they're not sure that they can trust Donald Trump not just kind of blow up the deal completely. And John Bolton is very, very hawkish on that deal. So very soon, we will see how the allies have to deal with this administration.
Okay. He is the Washington Bureau Chief for The Economist, David Rennie. We'll leave it there. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Let's get back now to our Unequal Justice series. For the past 2 weeks, our Across Women's Lives team has been reporting on the rising number of women going to prison around the world. In Thailand, women are being locked up in record numbers because of a growing level of meth use. In Mexico, numbers are rising as more women are working at the low end of the drug trade. And in the U.S., many lawmakers and judges have a lock-em-up attitude towards drug-related crime. What many of these women have in common is that their drug use is a result of trauma, and it seems the key to getting out and starting a new life is meeting someone who's also been in prison, someone who gets it and believes in you. Today, reporter Allison Herrera tells us about one woman in Tulsa, Oklahoma, who's starting over with a little help from her friends. And there are, let me quickly add, some disturbing details in Allison's story.
The reception area at S&R Compression in South Tulsa is pretty standard. There are People magazines neatly placed on small tables. On the walls are large, detailed pictures of machines the company builds for vapor recovery. If you want to know what that is, you'll need to look it up, because this story isn't about Oklahoma's oil and gas industry. It's about the woman behind the desk, Ronna Stone.
Hi. Hey, how are you?
Ronna is 40 years old and has a short black pixie cut with fire engine red streaks. She's also known to break out into a very loud laugh, even though she's a little reserved. Ronna is Chippewa Cree on her mom's side and grew up in a small town called Rocky Boy, Montana.
Are those your special work boots that you have to wear?
Well, I don't have to wear them, but...
This is the new Ronna Stone, the one with a good job and a nice haircut. But her early life was one of chaos. She grew up around drug abuse. At age 12, she was raped and became pregnant. The perpetrator of this crime controlled her life for years.
Pretty soon it just came to the point where nobody would want me around, because they knew he would come and he would take my baby and go hide him. And the very last time I ran, he took me and my baby out to this field and he put a gun to my baby's head, and my baby was like 8 months old. And, you know, he said he was going to shoot him or shoot us, and... So that was like the last time.
She did get away, but she was still using drugs and she was committing crimes. She did some time for grand larceny and false impersonation in 2009 and 2012. In 2015, she was looking at another prison sentence until someone paid her a visit at the Tulsa County Jail. This woman offered her a choice. Enter this treatment program and we will help you, or go to prison again.
She's like, do you remember me? And I was like, no. She said, I come interviewed you in 2009 and you weren't ready. She said, and I come interviewed you in 2012 and you're still not ready. And I just broke down.
She said she was ready to quit using. Her 23-year-old son got shot and died in a drug deal gone wrong.
I lost everything and everyone that I ever cared about.
This was the first step in Rana's new life. She entered Women in Recovery. It's an 18-month intensive treatment program for women based in Tulsa. It's not just detox. It's about changing the way you think about yourself, unlearning that life of addiction like the one Rana was leading. It's intense. Lots of group therapy, lots of opening up, lots of talking about the trauma and abuse that got you to that rock bottom place. For Rana, getting off the drugs was the easy part. It was being around others that was hard.
I just couldn't be around people I didn't know how. So that made me feel alienated and stuff. So the biggest part for me was having to stay here and be around these girls, being around these women, and then getting to know them. And, you know, when I got through that, it's like, you know what? I really like everybody. I like being here.
Even though it was hard, she stuck it out. The first time I met Rana was at the Women in Recovery graduation. There were flowers, shouts of congratulations, and lots of tears. She was shy, like she was still getting used to being better. She had long hair with bangs that covered her eyes. I knew she was working hard to support herself and was paying off almost $8,000 in fines and costs as a result of her arrest. It was tough, and so she was looking for a better job. Enter Christy Sanders, the vice president at SNR Compression. She hired Rana.
I have a natural affinity to want to help women, particularly ones who need a second chance. It's a big deal.
The oil and gas industry is a man's world, and so when Christy got promoted to a leadership position, she made it a goal to place more women on the shop floor, right alongside the men.
So I then say, tell me what interests you. You want to learn to weld? You want to learn to be an electrician? You want to learn to be an industrial painter? And then we slowly migrate that way. When that department needs somebody, that woman in recovery applicant goes there.
She places them in the entry-level janitorial position, then moves them up. She has a soft spot for these women, despite her no-nonsense attitude.
It comes by me naturally. I was raised by a single mother. She wasn't an addict. She was a school teacher. She struggled, you know, but it can be done. I mean, we lived on welfare. We got commodities, so I'm no goody two-shoes.
It's been a huge transformation for Rana. She's making more money and looks different. And in a sense, she's found her place.
From my past, everybody's always seen the worst in me. But now I have people that see the best in me and give me like a chance at an opportunity. I'm inspired here, and it just helps me to overcome like all life circumstances in my past.
At SNR, there are about a dozen women working on the shop floor right now. Six of them are from Women in Recovery. They are proud of welding, painting, and building these large machines. And like Rana, they don't want to go back.
Like, sometimes I'll have flashbacks of my past. Like, I remember this one time I was walking and I didn't have nothing. So it just makes me feel like, okay, today I have a choice to get up. I have a choice to go to work. I have a choice to do my job, you know, because I never want to go back to where I can never pay rent again.
For the World, Allison Herrera, Tulsa, Oklahoma.
You can see photos of Rana and the other people featured in our series. We have those on our Across Women's Lives Instagram feed. Go to Instagram and look for at Women's Lives. Just ahead, Dubai is missing a princess, maybe. You're with the World. I'm Marco Werman. You're tuned to the World. Dubai, luxury hotels, middies, vacation, and shopping destination. But remember, Dubai is also a strictly controlled monarchy. And one member of that royal family, a princess, seems to be missing. There are even allegations that she's been kidnapped under orders from her father. It is a complicated tale, but my colleague John McManus, who's covering the story for the BBC, has been telling us about the princess and what happened to her.
Sheikha Latifa Al Maktoum is one of the daughters of the ruler of Dubai, Sheikh Mohammed bin Rashid Al Maktoum. And Dubai, of course, is one of the United Arab Emirates, one of those very small, rich countries in the Middle East, which have grown rich on the back of oil, mostly. Now, Sheikha Latifa says that in the past, she tried to leave Dubai, but was stopped by her father and imprisoned for over 3 years. And in fact, there's a YouTube video, which anybody can access at the moment, where she speaks to the camera and says that she was imprisoned and that she was also tortured by her father's security services. What we now know, or what we've been told, is that earlier this year, Sheikha Latifa tried to escape Dubai again. She went over the border into the neighbouring country of Oman and then boarded a US-registered yacht called the Nostromo with her friend and Keep Fit instructor, a Finnish citizen, and also the captain of the yacht itself, a US citizen called Hervé Jobur. Hervé Jobur was at a press conference in London, which I attended, and he told us about the sequence of events. He said they left Oman with the princess on board and sailed for several days across the Indian Ocean, heading for India. He said he became aware that he was being tracked by boats. Two commando boats came up beside him, and the vessel was boarded by Indian commandos in international waters. He said that extreme violence was used against him and the other people on board the yacht, including the princess, and then they were all forcibly returned to the United Arab Emirates, where he was kept prisoner for more than a week. He said he was physically attacked, and he said his life was threatened as well before he was allowed to leave Dubai. We don't know what's happened to Sheikha Latifa. She seems to have disappeared.
All right, let's hear from Hervé Jobur.
I had no time to do anything. They put a gun to my face. I raised my arms. I saw a high-speed boat with seven, maybe eight commandos, all in black, no markings, helmet, black outfits, and laser sight. But no, they were Indian because they were coming from Indian Coast Guard ship.
Hervé Jobur says that when the commandos boarded his yacht, everybody was handcuffed and restrained, and that he saw the princess lying down on the deck of the yacht. For their part, I put these allegations to the Indian High Commission in London. They haven't responded to me. I also contacted the embassy of the United Arab Emirates. Again, I've not had a response for them for nearly a day now. We do only have the word of those involved in this incident about what happened, but it is clear that Sheikha Latifa has disappeared.
So there have been some reports, John, that Hervé Jobur, though, as you say, he's an American citizen, is a former French intelligence agent. Is there anything we should be reading into that?
Well, I've seen those reports. I can't confirm that. That may well be true, but I can't confirm if that is correct or not. What is clear is that Hervé Jobur was himself held prisoner in Dubai in the past for some incident. Now, I'm not sure what that was, but he did say he managed to escape from Dubai himself. And that's why the princess contacted Hervé Jobur and asked him to help them escape.
Do we have any idea why the princess might have been trying to leave Dubai?
Well, you know, as a member of the ruling family of Dubai, Sheikha Latifa was obviously very privileged, probably had a very comfortable lifestyle. But her friend Tina, who she recruited first as a Keep Fit instructor, but who became a very close friend, described the princess's lifestyle. She said that she yearned for freedom. She became interested in kind of very Western concepts like veganism. The pair of them took up skydiving at one point, Tina said. But she said, above all, despite her money, despite her wealth, and despite her status in Dubai, she longed to be free. And her experiences, in the princess's own words, her allegations that she was previously imprisoned on the orders of her father and that she was assaulted by members of his security services, that was the reason Tina said that Sheikha Latifa wanted to leave Dubai and begin a new life elsewhere. That's why they were heading to India.
Sounds like it has many, many layers to it. But at its root, John, do you think this is most likely a story about an oppressive royal family and their daughter who's kind of had enough of them and now she can't be found?
I think it may well be that. And just to reiterate, Marco, that we only have the word of the people who say they were involved in this incident at the moment, because both Dubai and India have not commented so far. So, you know, there is something to this story, I think. But as I say, we do need to hear some details from India and Dubai about their side of this story.
My BBC colleague John McManus, thanks very much for this.
You're welcome, Marco.
Very soon, or not so soon, That's what President Trump said recently about when U.S. missiles may be headed into Syria. The warning follows a suspected chemical attack on a rebel-held enclave outside of Damascus. While the Trump administration tries to figure out what, if anything, it's going to do, Syrian refugees living in the United States remain in limbo. My BBC colleague Laura Trevelyan recently met one of them in Connecticut.
Mohammed came here from Syria in 2016. He speaks to his mother in Jordan daily, desperate for her to join him here, and asks why the U.S. isn't doing more to assist Syrians, given their national nightmare.
I think Syrians are most people who need help now. They don't have time to wait.
Mohammed's mother fled from Syria to Jordan, and she's stuck there. The Trump administration's travel ban and enhanced security vetting for would-be refugees from Syria means her application is progressing slowly.
It's not clear when is this temporary life going to stop and when the normal life is going to start.
We've got a cluster of refugees in the Hartford area. And
for Chris George, who runs this refugee resettlement office in New Haven, the violence in Syria underscores why the Trump administration should be taking more refugees, not cutting back at a time of such great need.
Welcoming refugees is probably the best thing this country does. It's our oldest, most noble tradition. It's the Statue of Liberty in action.
Despite the efforts to resettle refugees here along the Connecticut coastline and across America, the Trump administration says it's too costly and the money will be better spent helping people fleeing persecution overseas. Critics of the White House say the attempt to cut the number of refugees is all part of a wider effort to limit legal immigration. Whatever the political environment may be, the peaceful atmosphere of small-town Connecticut is truly a refuge for Mohammed. He has a job and longs to get married.
The BBC's Laura Trevelyan reporting from just down the road from us in Connecticut. I'm Marco Werman. Adobo is a beloved dish in the Philippines and for many Filipinos here in the U.S., but not everyone appreciates it.
You know, going to school and having adobo and be like, oh, what is that brown stuff? Is it dog?
Newsflash, it isn't. Filipino chefs fight to get more respect for their food. That's still ahead here on The World. I'm Marco Werman, and you're with The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH here in Boston. Every Friday for the last 3 weeks, thousands of Palestinians in the Gaza Strip have taken part in demonstrations. The protests are happening at several locations, very close to the Israeli border fence, the divider between Israel and the 25-mile-long slice of land known as the Gaza Strip. Now, Israel's military says these are not just peaceful demonstrations, and its soldiers have responded with deadly force, rubber bullets and live ammunition. Hundreds of Palestinians have been injured, and so far at least 33 Palestinians have been killed. Earlier today, I spoke with two men, one on each side of that border fence. First, we're going to hear from Mohammed el-Baghdadi. He's Palestinian and lives in Gaza City. Baghdadi works for an NGO called the Norwegian Refugee Council. He says he's not taken part in the protests, but he knows a lot of people who have. And, of course, he's been following the story closely.
You will see families there. You see men, women, children, and people on normal days sometimes playing football. Sometimes they dance if it's not the peak in the clashes. Civilians are trying to protest and exercise their rights. So they go usually and demonstrate in five locations along the security fence. But unfortunately, in days like today, Friday, when the demonstrations reach the peak with thousands of people approaching there, it turns to be clashes and you hear the news about using deadly force against the protesters, and we have this big numbers of casualties and unfortunately killed people.
As to the risk and the danger, what are people in Gaza saying about why they go? Because if they're dangerous, what kind of reasons do they give for taking that risk?
Marco, it's not about why. If you want to understand why the people are going there, you have to look into the situation in Gaza in general. Gaza is a very small place, and the population of Gaza are 2 million people. And if you look in the past 10, 11 years, there is a blockade imposed to the strip. This blockade, still having an impact in all aspects of life. And there is a suffering for the Palestinian people. I'm pretty sure you're following in the news and you know what's happening about, there's like restrictions, no freedom of movement, a lot of restrictions imposed on access of items. We have a collapsed economy. We're looking about the health sectors, for example, in days like today. I have reading from Ministry of Health statistics about 45% of essential medicines are at zero stock. We're talking about hospitals suffering from chronic power deficits. If you look even at the children, if you talk about 11 years of blockade and you have a whole new generation of children, they know nothing about this life, but the blockade, the ongoing violence, it's, you know, the three rounds of hostilities happened in Gaza in the past 10 years. We're talking about 300,000 children are in need of psychosocial support here. The whole situation in Gaza Strip is really bad. So that's from one side. Mm-hmm. And if you look at the other side, the name of the demonstrations are the Great March of Return. So, and it's supposed to be a 6-week activities will end on the 15th of May, which is a Nakba day here.
Yeah, remind us what Nakba means.
A Nakba, it's an Arabic word. It means catastrophe, and it's commemorized the day of or the events happened and took place in 1948 when the Palestinians had to flee from their houses, and there's 750,000 Palestinians actually were expelled. So that's what the Palestinians, it's a very bad situation, and they want to exercise their right to claim the right of return. So that's basically the main theme of the demonstrations.
Do the protesters feel like these demonstrations could change things? What do they hope?
They're hoping for a better future for everyone. So this is basically what they're trying to do.
Gaza City resident Mohammed El Baghdadi, thank you very much.
You're welcome. Thank you for having me with you today.
Not too far from Gaza City and very close to that border fence is the Kibbutz Sufa. It's an Israeli community founded in 1982. Eyal Brandeis has lived there for 32 years. From his house on the last few Fridays, he says he could see smoke and hear voices coming from those Palestinian protests. So I asked Brandeis what he makes of the demonstrations.
I can understand the frustration of the Gazan people from their situation. And then again, I know that the protest is not spontaneous. It's well organized by the Hamas government. But the problem is that the Hamas does not want peace with Israel. It does not want us to leave here. So I cannot accept their demands to throw me away from my house, from where I've been living for the past 30 years.
Do you support the rights of Palestinians to protest?
It's not for me to say if I support their right to protest. I do not support the demand for us to leave Israel and to leave our house and to leave our homes. That I cannot support, and I cannot understand. I can understand the demand, but I do not support, and I think the demand is wrong. I would like us both to live here in peace. They live in Gaza, and I'll live where I live, and can live on in peace. I can understand the protest, but I think the protest should be against the Hamas government and not against Israel, which is doing more than Hamas for the Gazan people.
So we just heard from a Palestinian man who works for an NGO in Gaza, and we've been hearing this for years, that the people who live in the Gaza Strip have been deprived of basic necessities because of the blockade, food and medicine shortages, and children's health is suffering as a result. A lot of people's health is suffering. It feels like if Gazans protest, there's risk to life and limb. If they don't protest, then they're accepting these rotten conditions. Do you see the dilemma?
Yes, I do. But let me ask you this. Why don't they protest against the Egyptians who closed their borders from to Gaza? The only country that does put aid into the Gaza Strip now is Israel, including food, including other things. The Hamas government, instead of taking the aid they get from the European euros and putting it in hospitals, education, and jobs and welfare of the people, all they do is arm themselves against Israel. We have a right to defend ourselves, and we have to do this blockade, because if we don't, we will not be alive. The world should see what is going on. If the world expects someone to open the blockade, why don't they put the pressure on Egypt that they opened up, located the depot in Gaza, and allowed the Gazans to go in and out from their borderline.
Eyal Brandeis, thank you very much for your thoughts today.
Welcome. Have a great day.
Adobo, lechon, kare-kare. If you haven't heard of these Filipino dishes, don't feel bad, but yes, you are behind the curve. Filipino food seems to be hitting the mainstream here, and some are asking, why did it take so long? One storyline goes that it's partly because Filipinos in the U.S. are embarrassed about their food. But Rosalind Tordesillas doesn't buy it.
On a Sunday at 4, it's not quite lunch or dinner time, but Ihawan is packed. Filipinos would call this meal merienda cena, afternoon snack time, blending into dinner. This restaurant in Woodside, Queens, prides itself on giving Filipinos a taste of home. And as far as I can tell, everyone in here is of Filipino descent. Now, some food writers might look at Ihawan and conclude Filipinos are too ashamed of their food to bring white people here. Here's a clip from an episode of Feast Meets West, a podcast on Asian cuisines.
We were reading in the Washington Post about how some Filipino immigrants in America have felt a sense of shame or dishonor around their food.
There's been a number of stories about Filipino food in the U.S. that talk about a feature of Philippine culture called hiya, H-I-Y-A.
And they use the term hiya, and it's weird because it's not something that I've heard other Asian cultures feel about their food.
So let's clear something up. Yes, the literal translation of shame is hiya. But when you're talking about Philippine culture, hiya has a much deeper meaning. Hiya is part of a value system that guides how people act.
All of this really is a reflection of how we see ourselves as connected to other people.
EJ David is a professor focusing on Filipino psychology at the University of Alaska, Anchorage.
We don't just see ourselves as an individual, person that I will do whatever I want. I don't care what everybody else thinks.
Hiya means accountability to others, your family, friends, or community. It's knowing they have a stake in your actions and they will judge. It's respecting community standards. And it is shameful if you fall short. So how did this get translated into Filipinos being ashamed of their food? At some point, that cultural meaning of hiya got confused with a different meaning of hiya, the shame minorities feel when their food is ridiculed.
Going to school and, having adobo and be like, oh, what is that brown stuff? Is it dog?
That's Natalia Rojas talking about the comments she used to get about her lunch. She and Sarilyn Pablo founded Filipino Kitchen. They organize food and heritage events from their base in Chicago. Pablo tells me about a recent workshop they did with Filipino college students.
And we asked, had they ever been called or heard the term dog eaters as a pejorative against our community? And like a third of them raised their hands. Yes, it's a century ago, but like that idea still persists.
A century ago, a fake village of real indigenous Filipinos was a big hit at the St. Louis World's Fair. Crowds gawked at brown people performing a dog-eating ritual. As the U.S. began an almost 50-year occupation of the Philippines, Filipinos were shown as savages who had to be civilized. In the Philippines, American colonizers set up the public school system. Kids were taught that Filipino food was unhealthy, and that Western dishes and processed food like canned milk were superior. That colonial influence lingers, even though the Philippines gained independence in 1946. Filipinos are quite familiar with American tastes and how their food is presented in the U.S.
You must consume 2 balut eggs.
Dishes like balut, boiled fertilized duck eggs, are punishments on shows like Fear Factor.
If you are going to throw out, I have a bucket for you.
Oh, God. I hear a crunch. This is hot. She's a savage. Look at that.
It's no surprise some Filipinos have internalized all that shaming. But even those who unapologetically love the food can't escape those prejudices.
Ito, this is so good. Look at how pretty it is. Oh. You have to cut it properly. So that's one of the things...
Amy Bessa is among the foremost ambassadors of Philippine food in the U.S. She and her husband, Romy Doratan, own Purple Yam in Brooklyn. When they first started out, they wanted to feature the flavors they loved, but they knew what they were up against.
Because we felt that if we say it, we said, oh, this is a Filipino restaurant, then, you know, all kinds of limiting stereotypes will come in.
And when she heard that some were attributing this type of caution to a cultural trait, hiya, and calling it shame?
I remember reading it the first time, and I was so angry.
Bessa says citing cultural sources of shame for why Filipino food isn't better known here is putting blame in the wrong place.
Because there are barriers that we did not create that prevent us from equal access and support to move our food towards that place where we want it to be. And if we were able to move in spite of all the barriers, it's because, oh, they allowed us. So when we make progress, guess who gets credited for it? What? Andrew Zimmern and Anthony Bourdain, excuse me.
And I think Filipinos in America maybe underrated their own food. They used to be mocked for balut.
Anthony Bourdain told CNN, you know, that Filipinos have underrated their own food and that sisig would be the breakout dish. No one has to tell Filipinos not to be ashamed to enjoy crunchy, garlicky, rich, spicy sisig. Chopped meat from a pig's face and ears, sizzling and gooey with a raw egg cracked over it. Professor E.J. David says it's not Filipinos who've underrated this food.
The conversation about, you know, why Filipino food has been ignored by mainstream America for so long. Well, the reason for that is mainstream America.
For The World, Rosalind Tordesillas, New York.
Rosalind's story was produced in collaboration with Feet in Two Worlds. On Monday, we'll have this story for you. Ireland has one of the toughest anti-abortion laws in Europe. The right to life for the unborn is protected in the Irish Constitution. It's Ireland's Eighth Amendment, written into law in 1983. Next month, voters in Ireland are giving it a second look with a yes-no vote on repealing the Eighth Amendment, and campaigners from both sides are busy.
Would you like a leaflet? We're campaigning for a yes vote in the referendum.
Listen, I'm talking as an uncle of a 13-year-old who got pregnant.
Sure.
You know?
Okay, well, look, you know, we're both coming at it from different angles here, I suppose. And thank you for your time.
Thank you
for
talking to us. I'm not arguing, and I'm not debating. I just think that life is so phenomenally important, as is the life of the woman carrying it.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
I'm not diminishing that in any shape or form, and I'm not belittling that in any shape or form.
Irish voters decide whether to end the ban on abortion. That's on the show Monday. The Summit of the Americas is taking place in Lima, Peru, but the occasional gathering of regional leaders is one high-profile American short this week, President Donald Trump. Trump bowed out earlier this week, citing the need to oversee the crisis in Syria. Vice President Mike Pence is there in Trump's place, and daughter Ivanka Trump is also in Lima. Michael Camilleri is the director of the Inter-American Dialogue's Rule of Law Program, and he joins us from the summit at the Convention Center in Lima, Peru. I mean, relations between Trump and many Latin American countries wasn't so good to begin with. Do you think his not going to the Summit of the Americas could further deteriorate relations? What kind of impact do you think those absences will have?
I think the absences certainly take some of the air and anticipation out of the summit. For many of these leaders, especially from small countries, this was probably their one chance to meet the U.S. president. He's the first U.S. president to skip a Summit of the Americas since they started in 1994. So that's significant for U.S. Latin American relations. At the same time, it does remove the risk that's born of Trump's impulsiveness and his unpredictability. He has had a tendency with regard to issues in Latin America, whether it's immigration or drugs or trade, to say things that are, you know, provocative in ways that aren't positively viewed by the region. And his abysmal approval ratings in the region, I think, reflect that. And so, yes, it's significant that he's not here, but it also removes the risk that things could blow up even further.
The theme of this year's summit is corruption, which is kind of awkward in a lot of ways. President Trump has been under scrutiny in the U.S. pretty much since he got into office for various conflicts of interest. Venezuelan President Nicolas Maduro was barred from attending the summit, and there's no shortage of corrupt practices there in Venezuela. And in Peru, where the summit's being held. The president was forced from office about a month ago. What kind of conversations about corruption have you been hearing?
So it's interesting, as you said, I mean, corruption is kind of the shadow hanging over not just this summit, but the region right now. You know, you look around and there are a number of presidents that are either under investigation and a couple of cases have already had to, you know, be forced from office. So clearly this is the issue of the moment in the region. And I think it's positive that the summit is trying to take this on, as awkward as that may be. What we are hearing is that there is a good chance the leaders will adopt a formal declaration on corruption. This is really significant because the past few summits have ended without any sort of consensus on any issue, much less one that's so central and topical.
And will that be a binding declaration? Will it be consequential?
No, it won't be binding. It will be a statement of intent. And obviously, the devil is not just at the details, but in the follow-up and the implementation. There's a long road to run on this, but certainly it's better than nothing and important that at least they will come to some sort of consensus.
As I said, Venezuelan President Nicolas Maduro has been barred from the summit. But how do you think the economic and political crisis in Venezuela is going to be dealt with?
So this, I think, is the most likely source of fireworks when the leaders meet. Most of the major countries in the Americas at this point are united in extreme concern about the crisis in Venezuela, the authoritarian measures taken by the government of Nicolas Maduro, the human rights abuses, but also the extremely dire economic and humanitarian situation. And so there's a lot of unity there, but Venezuela is not without friends. And with Maduro not being here, I think you can count on some of his friends, whether it's the Cubans or the Nicaraguans or the Bolivians, making a big deal out of the fact that he's been excluded and trying to provoke a fight with whether it's Vice President Pence or some of the others who are critical of Venezuela. I'm not expecting any major policy moves or announcements, but we know that behind the scenes there will be discussions about what comes next in terms of pressuring and isolating the regime of Nicolas Maduro.
Do you think the summit is more symbolic than a real way to address problems within and between the countries in the region?
I think there's a big symbolic component to any of these leadership meetings, but I don't think the symbolism should be disregarded. I think there's some importance to that, and I think what we've seen at summits past is that on the really big issues, you need to get leaders in the room, and significant things can happen. I think the 2012 summit, for example, was significant on hemispheric drug policy. It was significant in shaping the thinking of President Barack Obama on U.S.-Cuba policy. And the last summit in 2015 was, of course, the moment at which Cuba was sort of welcomed back into the hemispheric community and the U.S. was rolling out, at least under the past administration, a new approach to engaging with Cuba and trying to push for democratic and economic change in Cuba. So there's a high quotient, I think, of, as you say, kind of pomp and circumstance and symbolism. But there are certain decisions that can only be made at this level. And so they matter for that reason.
Have you spotted Ivanka Trump yet? And what role will she play at the summit?
I haven't seen her personally. She's actually about to take the stage where I am very shortly. I know she's been doing some press conferences and things. I think she's been quite well received. She's engaging heavily with the business community, especially here at the summit. And I think that's an audience that is receptive to her and to her message and to her background as a businesswoman and as an envoy of her father, the president. Ultimately, you know, the business community, like its leaders in Latin America, is looking at U.S. policy, particularly on trade, with a degree of trepidation and confusion and sort of whiplash in terms of President Trump's seeming flirtation with rejoining the Trans-Pacific Partnership, TPP, again.
Whiplash is the word of the day. It sounds like it's lunch there, so we're going to let you go. Michael Camilleri is the director of the Inter-American Dialogue's Rule of Law Program, joining us from the Summit of the Americas in Lima, Peru. Thanks very much, Michael.
Thank you.
If you are one of the lucky ones to attend the Summit of the Americas, and I'm not being sarcastic here, you may have been handed this. One selection from a CD called Rock Contra la Dictadura, Rock Against the Dictatorship. On the cover is a picture of Venezuelan President Maduro with a crown superimposed on his head. The album was put together by a couple of Venezuelan human rights groups critical of Maduro's government. As you heard earlier, the theme of the summit in Lima is corruption, and this song, Paradise, is a play on the phrase paraíso fiscal, fiscal paradise. That's how you say tax haven in Spanish. It's also a reference to the Panama Papers, that massive trove of documents that uncovered a whole lot of shady deals done in Panama in attendance at the summit. The track is by Emigdio and the Superpower, a rock band fronted by Venezuelan singer Emigdio Perez. Maybe you can hear the lyrics turning into an automated phone message for a fictitious Paradise Bank. They go, if you're calling to launder money, press 3. To avoid paying taxes, press 4. To bribe a government official, press 5. You get the picture. If any Latin American leaders play the CD in their hotel rooms tonight, I'm not sure they'll get the picture. It may hit too close to home, but that's kind of the point. Serious stuff with a pretty serious groove. That'll do it for us today. Our theme music was composed by Eric Goldberg. The World comes to you from the Nan and Bill Harris studios at WGBH here in Boston. I'm Marco Werman. Have a good weekend, everybody. Mire que ya instalamos el gobierno popular.
PRI, Public Radio International.